We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Thank you for listening to Spin, the Rally Pod, brought to you by Dirtfish Rally School. For your chance to experience life behind the wheel of a rally car, head to drive.dirtfish.com to find the course that's right for you. What are you waiting for? We're right here waiting for you.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Spin the Rally Pod from Dirtfish. I'm James Bowen and here to guide you through what is a very special edition of Spin the Rally Pod because it's our first ever listener special. That's right, to celebrate the end of another year and of course the festive season, we're giving you control of the podcast. You've sent in your questions. So now it's time to introduce three men who will hopefully have some answers for us. We've got David Evans. Hello, David.
James, good morning. How are you?
Very well, very well. You sound like you've just woken up, David.
No. I've been awake. I woke at six. Oh, in fact, I woke at about just after five and then tried to get back to sleep and did. But then woke at six and was so excited about answering these questions, I couldn't get back to sleep. So bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
That's what we like to hear. We also have Colin Clark. How are you, Colin?
Morning, James. Yes, I'm very well indeed. I've also been up since 5 o'clock, but I've had my four shredded wheat this morning, so I am feeling absolutely ready to go.
You're ready to go, exactly. And of course, we have George Donaldson with us. Good morning, George.
Good morning, James. I've got a cup of tea. I've not had breakfast yet, but I am bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready for these questions.
George
just
never
sleeps.
Excited. George doesn't have time to sleep, do you, George?
No. Oil industry and trying to keep up with all our rally stuff. It's quite an exciting enough hobby, I think, as it is these days for me.
Yeah.
Highly enjoyable. What can I say?
Right, question. Come on. I genuinely can't wait for these questions, James. Are any of them nasty? We don't want any nasty ones.
Of course, there's no nasty ones. There's some intriguing ones, David, and there's ones I think you'll quite enjoy. So we should say, dear listeners, our panel of experts, as we'll call them, haven't actually seen those questions yet. So it will genuinely be off the cuff answers. But indeed, thank you to everyone who did send in questions because the response has been really great. So, thank you for that. And we'll do our best to answer all of them in this episode, but we might end up doing a two-parter. We will see. So stick with us. Without further ado, guys, shall we jump into question number one?
Yes.
Okay, David, I'm going to throw this one your way. This was actually our most popular question. So thanks to everyone who sent this one in. And essentially, the question is, what should the future of the top class of the WRC be?
Can I pass on that? Am I allowed to pass at all?
What an absolutely blinding start that is, David.
Yeah. Well, this time last week, so here's the thing. Oh, you know, we said we were going to get this done an hour and we were going to rapidly get through these questions. We're not, obviously. So the phone rings on Friday afternoon and it's a strange number that I don't recognise. I'm like, ooh, what do I do with that one? So I thought, no, I'll answer it. So I answered it. And the voice at the other end said, David, it's Mohammed bin Sulayem. I was very surprised.
Oh, my word.
Mr. President calling. And we chatted for ages. And just, you know, I think it's almost impossible to overstate what a big week last week was in terms of deciding the future of the World Rally Championship. And for me, going into last week, it kind of had to be Rally 2. I could see complete sense in the safety and numbers aspect of just having a lot of cars out there. Can totally understand the technical director's feelings that, you know, it's a massive step back no hybrid, you know, very little aero and far, far less powerful cars. But as I say, it just brings an opportunity to put an awful lot of cars, an awful lot of drivers in cars to win the championship and make more spectacular competition. By the end of the week, my head had given way to my heart. And as you'd read in Dirtfish's story on Monday, it seems that Rally One will stay. The manufacturers are committed to it. And there's, I think, if for me, the absolute best would be an affordable Rally One, which at the minute we don't have. But equally, I'd caveat that and say, well, we need cars that are affordable. We need a championship that delivers value to manufacturers, which, again, we don't have. Because I keep banging on and going back to the whole cost of cars. Look at a car that competes in the World Endurance Championship. It's millions. It's way, way more expensive than a Rally One car. But the difference is manufacturers will pay that because they're getting the value and the return on investment from the championship, which we're sadly not right now. So, oh, God. Rally One. I'll go with Rally One.
What I don't understand, David, is why they seem to think they can get more value out of these ridiculously expensive cars than they could get out of a ridiculously successful championship featuring their car, the same car, but with less engineering on it. Why do they think a heavily engineered car gets better marketing value than a less engineered car? I don't understand it. You know, gone are the days where Audi could say, we've got this wonderful new system that they call four-wheel drive and that they can sell thousands, hundreds of thousands of units because of that. Gone are those days. There's no innovation in terms of the engineering in Rally One cars these days. It's all prescribed. It's all prescribed to the manufacturers.
And Toyota don't even put the word hybrid on the back of their car.
Absolutely
because it's
not
their hybrid.
It's not their hybrid. So I don't understand. I think that is a really... It's an argument that I've heard many times, but I would like it explaining why. Why does a heavily engineered car that's enormously expensive potentially deliver you more value than a really strong championship using the same car? It'll be Pumas, it'll be Yaris's, it'll be I-20s, it'll be the same car, for goodness sake.
But it'll be more relevant to the man in the street because it'll look a wee bit more like his car.
Exactly. So I think for me, that's absolute nonsense. I don't get it. I don't get it.
There is a point made by the manufacturers, from what I understand, within the meeting, big meeting on Thursday, and the point from the manufacturers, which is an understandable one, and George, you'll get this from a team perspective.
I'm ready to make an input here.
they've invested in what was a three-year homologation cycle has become a five-year homologation cycle. They've invested, so the cost of the Rally One car has essentially been divided across 5 years. So for the next 3 years, that car owes them a living, owes the manufacturer a living. That's one of the arguments being put forward by the teams. And you can understand that, because the significant investment costs, they kind of have to be considered. You could just ditch that. Equally, we'd lose Ford at the drop of a hat. We would lose Ford because Ford won't participate in WRC without hybrid. So George, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are... don't get me wrong. I love engineers. I love engineering, obviously, and I've had great relationships with many, many engineers in many, many teams. But I'll bet you a pound to a penny that everybody in that meeting from the teams was engineers. They don't want their baby. They don't want to lose their high-tech babies. And that's normal, and it's fantastic, and it's right from their perspective. But it's completely wrong for the sport and ultimately wrong for the manufacturers. You say we're going to lose Ford if we drop the Rally One car. Mm. Well, Ford, I get it, but we've effectively lost them anyway. You know, we've got a car there, but it's not actually really being leveraged at all. It's not got the budget to be able to be leveraged. So it's actually, sadly, the last couple of years just been a sideline. It's given us a couple of victories because they managed to get great drivers, but they had problems because, again, lack of investment. So the loss of Ford per se is not a problem. So that I'm going to just rule out. I'm sorry, Malcolm, but you know, this is a passionate aspect, and the knowledge that you, Ford, M Sport, will be able to make a Puma R5 car or Rally 2 car, which will be so close to having similar power to the current car as beyond true. Maybe the rules could be changed to even allow you to have a hybrid, your own hybrid. Mm. Put whatever you want on it. It can be a light hybrid. Ford seem to like to do that on their cars anyway, a meaningless hybrid system on it, on their road cars, as far as I'm concerned. I've tried a few. They were a bit boring. But the bottom line is, Malcolm would have 5 times the volume of business that he currently has. He would be able to afford to run top drivers in his top Puma Rally 5 car or Rally 2 car, the new Rally 1 car. So that argument has absolutely zero credence to my mind. Mm. This is a decision which I'm very surprised that has been based on lack of backbone. Somebody should have just made the decision.
Yeah. That I've got to say, that's a bit of my feeling. That, you know, there's and actually the decision, we should emphasise, the decision isn't made yet. It hasn't gone to World Council, but there are obviously going to be some issues Cole.
No. David, look, you know, I get, you know, I'm listening very carefully for once to what you're saying, because you very much, I always do, David, you know I always do.
You didn't let him finish.
No, I didn't let him finish because I had a point, you know, and I think, you know, I listened to what you say about the investment. I get that, the development costs. And there is an investment over a certain period. And you know, and it's not just the engineers, George. It's accountants that run all these things. It's accountants and engineers. Between them, the two of them can make everything work, apparently. You know, they want their money back. Fine. Let's keep these hybrids for 24, maybe 25. But then let's have a very positive indication that, you know, that at the end of that period, we will be having something that's way more affordable, that's way more attractive to manufacturers, that offers many, many more potential seats for drivers and makes the whole, it reinvigorates the championship because it needs reinvigorating. And it's clear that Mohammed Ben Salim understands that. But, you know, we just, you know, this kind of, you know, it's got to be Rally 1, it's got to be hybrid. I'm with you, Georgie. It's a lack of backbone. We all know it's wrong. We all know it's wrong. Everyone knows it was a dud move. It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy at the time. It offered no engineering value. It offered no marketing value. It offered no relevance to the man in the street. It offered no innovation because hybrids had been around for 25, 30 years. You know, it was wrong from the start. And when something's wrong, what do? Do you keep throwing good money after bad, or do you cut your losses? Do you stand up and say, nah, this is wrong? And this is where Mohammed Ben Salim needs to show his worth. Say, no, it's not working. Let's do something different. That's what I think. Anyway. No,
okay. Yeah. Well, whatever the future of Rally 1 is, of course, you can find out all the news on what is going to happen with the top class on dirtfish.com.
But extending it for 5 years, that's a catastrophe.
Catastrophe.
Yeah, they're not extending it for 5 years. But anyway, it's interesting that we've now got 31 questions to go and we're already 12 minutes in.
Well, the next one, hopefully, should be a bit easier for you guys. Sorry, I was a bit nasty there. I put the most difficult one first. But anyway, Alicia on X asks, what is your favourite rally on the calendar, past or present, and why? So, Colin Clark, your favourite rally, please.
I'm still struggling to get used to X, by the way. I've not even updated my app. It's still Twitter on my app. My favourite rally, Coffs Harbour Rally Australia. I absolutely loved it. The perfect place for a round of the World Rally Championship. The right size town. Far enough away from cities, and that, you know, city, as we found out recently, enormous cities and rallying just don't mix. You know, we are a rural sport, we're a countryside sport, we're out and about in the hills and the glens and all the rest. Coffs Harbour, great town, great place, service park 2 minutes from an airport, a town that absolutely embraced the rally, a local political scene that embraced it, some great roads. I absolutely loved Coffs Harbour.
A town of 8 people.
It doesn't matter, David. It doesn't. It was big enough.
Sorry.
It was big enough to support. It was
very rude. I loved it as well.
But I understand that argument. I understand it, and I don't get it. You know, we have to make a decision. Are we rallying for cities like London, like Melbourne, like Buenos Aires, or are we a sport that's based outside of the cities? And my view is that we can't work in cities. We saw it in Auckland last year, David. You know, we trundled 2 hours down to the most beautiful part of the world with the best rally stages in the world. We get the fever in New Zealand and we do the Fonga Coast and we do Te Akau and all the rest, and we're absolutely fizzing. By the time we get back to a little service park, tucked away in a corner of the industrial part of the harbour, in the pouring rain, we've sat in the traffic for an hour and a half to get there. It just doesn't work. Doesn't work. Sorry. Yeah. So anyway, so no, Coffs right. Harbour, just to make it simple.
Okay.
Coffs Harbour, my favourite by not a long way, but by a reasonable way.
George, quickly, your favourite rally, please.
I mean, honestly, there's so many fantastic rallies. The old San Remo that ran down through Tuscany, Argentina, just utterly, utterly amazing. It's just a rally not to be missed. As a spectator, as a team member, as a competitor, brilliant. But of course, the classic safaris that we used to do up until 1995 was the last proper one. 96 wasn't bad, but it was already heavily denuded when all the teams came. Became an easier event to do, which was valid. I don't decry that move at all. Far from it. I applauded it. But the pre-95 safari rallies, they were just to be loved. And like Colin, Australia, but Western Australia. I loved the rally in Perth, and that gave us the best super special stage of all time, and the only super special stage that was, you couldn't not go and watch it because it was so spectacular. Tell me that of any other stage. The cars were doing 130, 140 kph, 150 kph over a jump, all right in front of you over a 450 metre stadium. The corners at the end were 200 metre wide hairpins. The cars were completely sideways all the time. Just spectacular.
Pro racing in Argentina.
Oh yeah,
that was almost as good.
Never got to see that one because obviously working servicing. So
That was good.
But yeah, the film of it was good. Yeah, never actually saw it in the flesh. Again, everything in Argentina pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, that's true. For me, probably going to be a little. This can be, James. This can be. It doesn't need to be a current rally or anything. It can. I can go
past
all the way
or present.
Back.
Yeah, whatever right. You like.
It's going to, for me, it has to be an old style RAC rally. And one I never worked on, obviously. But the sort of thing, you know, 95, chasing Colin McRae around with my father, going on a linear route up and down the country. Just absolutely loved it. The sense of occasion was massive.
Yeah. An adventure, David.
100% adventure. Absolutely, yeah. George. It was just brilliant. And some of the best roads in the world. And just living it for 5 days, sleeping in the car, it was amazing. It's everything that I love about this sport. So yeah, that one for me.
All rallying, one source. By now, you know that dirtfish.com is the place to go for all of your rallying news. But when it's time to try your hand behind the wheel, just join us here at Dirtfish Rally School, nestled in the Cascade Mountains in Snoqualmie, Washington. Whether you're a pro seeking extra seat time or a novice looking to get started, we've got programs tailored to all rallying needs. And when you want to watch the best in the world, just head over to our YouTube channel. Our coverage of the WRC and American rallying is second to none. Follow us at Dirtfish Rally across all social media platforms and shop the latest looks in our merchandise store now. As always, rally on.
Next question, Colin, I'm going to send your way. Comes from Patrick on Facebook, and he asks, does the WRC still need personal driver's numbers? He says he gets why F1 and MotoGP have them, but he can't understand why WRC with so few drivers needs personal numbers. He said he'd rather see the drivers in manufacturer order. Colin, what are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, look, you know, I get that point that he wants to see them in manufacturer order, but you know what? It's about marketing, isn't it? You know, Valentino Rossi was the one that started it. Ken Block. It's all part of the marketing of the driver himself. It's all part of the merchandising. It all helps to build the characters. So, I love it. I love it. I think personal driver numbers, to me, it doesn't make any difference. You know, I know who the manufacturers are. I know who the manufacturer drivers are. So I do get that maybe you know, there's the argument that it does simplify things by keeping them in whatever it might be, a 1 to 10 number or whatever. But no, I think it all adds. I think giving them their own personal numbers just adds to the ability of the driver to market themselves, to sell themselves, to build their own characters. And that's what we need. We need characters and personalities. And that's all part of it.
Yeah, brilliant. And you see some drivers who do actually try and work with it. I think Callie Rovanperä uses his number quite a lot in his marketing. Thierry Neuville's another one.
He does. Others,
yeah. Others not so much.
Moving on.
Ken Block was the one who did it best. Ken Block and as I say, Valentino Rossi, just, you know, they built brands out of their numbers, didn't they?
Yeah.
They did, yeah. George, next question I'm going to send to you. It comes from Jonathan on Facebook, and he asks, why did Group S get cut if it was supposed to be safer than Group B? With limited horsepower, I think about 300 horsepower was the target for Group S. George, what are your thoughts on that one?
Well, actually, a slight misconception there. Group S was never going to be 300 horsepower. It was the same as Group B, and I think it was just an homologation difference. It was the way that you homologated it. The cars were Group B plus. So the Toyota car came, and actually it did have an MR2 bulkhead and floor, I think. The original MR2 bulkhead and floor, but the rest was basically space framed. So maybe the centre part of the tub. But I remember looking at that car, I mean, literally as it got rolled off the transport and into the warehouse. The Group B had been cancelled about a week before in a World Council meeting. Yay! Group B cancelled, not really. But I'm thinking as an analogy to what we could do this year. That car was unbelievably special. Myself and my friend Andy Burnett were across in Cologne working on clearing out a workshop of all the old Group B stuff that we had. We'd been pulled across. So it was literally just a week before we'd got a phone call, and it must have been before Christmas. I think we were across there for the Christmas party, I think is what we were there for, which was very small at that time. In 1996, and we worked away for about 3 weeks, putting things in the skip. I mean, literally, and the skip was out the back, and anybody could drive around the back. And Andy and I were just going crazy. We were looking at stuff, discussing it, thinking, what would you do with this incredible gearbox? And it went in the skip. And Andy and I, we were in tears. We were in tears. Andy was stronger than me, but. Crikey. And then Richard Cragen, a man who ended up running a lot of Formula One races, he came in every now and again, and he came through and he said, oh, there's the Group S car. He'd seen it already, of course. And he came in, and he didn't have the ECU for it, but he jumped into it, and we connected up a battery and turned it over and got the oil pressure up on the engine just as a preservation action to, you know, make sure the oil was around the engine every now and again. That was the car with the inline engine. So the previous versions had been transverse. This was the inline one. It never ever got tested, sadly. So Group S was cancelled because it was even crazier than Group B, to be honest.
Right.
It was going to be more powerful, more freedoms for the manufacturers. And honestly, I mean, I think even at that time, they wouldn't have got any easier to drive. The Group B cars were animals, as Walter Rall described them, as they were very, very difficult to drive. But in a previous generation, I remember being told that, one of the old Saab drivers, I don't think it was Eric Carlson, I think it was pre-Eric Carlson, had said when the two-stroke Saab came out, and it had 90 horsepower or something, the three-cylinder, two-stroke Saab 94 or 92, or what, it must have been a 92, came out with 75, 80 or 90 horsepower. He drove it and he came back shaking, saying, look, I can manage that, but only just, but that's the absolute limit of power. Mm-hmm. A funny story. But Walter Rall said the same thing, and we know that already in the first year of Group A, by the end of the first year of Group A, the Group A cars were actually faster than the Group B cars on times. But that's because better suspension started to come, and more importantly, better tyres, the Pirelli and Michelin. I don't know, it'd be a really interesting story this, David, to find out what massive difference there was in tyres from 1986 to 1987, 88, 89. There was some huge development in tyre technology came along.
Yeah.
And those old enough can remember it, you know, even on road tyres, it was huge. So, yeah, Group S was a disaster. Sorry, long answer. Apologies. Stop.
That's brilliant. Brilliant insight, George. I think that's really cleared that one up. Thank you for that. Next one, guys. I'm going to...
Is it? Good.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm going to give this one to all three of you guys next. So answers, fingers on the buzzers, please. If you could make a three-car team from any drivers in the WRC, who would be in that team and why? David Evans, you can go first.
Is that past or present again? Or
present, I think.
Just present.
From the current crop, yeah.
So in my team, I would have Calle Rovanpera. I would have Oit Tanak. And I would have Elvin Evans. We needed a bit more context around the question, James. Is it just for one season of glory, or is it with an eye to a 5-year plan for the future?
Come on, guys, you've answered the question already. You've done very well. Josh, don't spoil it, David.
I've given you all the context we've got, David, I'm afraid. We just have to use our imaginations.
Sorry.
George Donaldson, your three-car team, who's in it?
I'm going to answer this question slightly different, James. Let's just point out the fact that when you've got two top drivers in a team, things can get quite contentious. Yeah, and quite difficult to handle. And Toyota have managed that very well this year. Hyundai didn't manage it very well the last time they had two top drivers. Let's be honest, that wasn't brilliant at any stage. It was fractious. So I'm thinking it myself. I would do the same as Colin. I would have Seb Ogier, assuming that I could get a full year out of him. I think I would then take one of the failed drivers, likes of Andreas Mikkelsen or Hayden Paddon, because I think they still have the potential to do well, and they would actually recognise to give a great backup to Seb Ogier, and I think both of them would suck up the experience, as in fact Andreas has demonstrated before when he was at VW. And the third driver, honestly speaking, I'll take the biggest chance of all, and maybe slightly romantic in that I'm just desperate to see young drivers succeed, having been one myself. I'm going to give Adrian Formoe a go. So there you are, Ogier, Hayden Paddon or Andreas Mikkelsen, and Adrian Formoe, I believe he's got a great chance.
You got four drives in a three-driver team then?
No, I said or. I haven't decided yet. I'm still deciding. Whichever one I could get.
All right. I think both of them Sebastian were worth a, both or of them Oit were Tanak, worth
a chip. I mean, you or could I take might have
had, or I might have had as, Oliver Solberg. Or I might have had, not very decisive that, George.
Okay, so Noel and Bradley on Facebook ask what are our thoughts on Rally Ireland's WRC bid for 2025. David Evans, any update on that one yet?
Not so much. It does sound like it's got some credibility and some backing, so I think we just need to wait and see. Obviously, the plan to run the event out of Belfast, which Bobby Willis worked tirelessly on, has gone now. That opportunity has passed, which is an absolute crime and a crying shame. But yeah, I think Ireland is still somewhere in the wings. Obviously, I mean, it's a long process. Firstly, for the event to get the backing and all of the cash and everything in place and the organisation and infrastructure. And then, obviously, there's a whole process to go through with the FAA and WRC promoter that you need to run a candidate event and everything. So it's probably a couple of years away, but I would say it's still being talked about and there's still... vaguely a possibility. It's probably more than that. There is a good possibility, I would say, because the promoter's always been very clear as well that it wants participation in our part, in Britain and Ireland, this part of the world. And historically, we need it. I think it's good. It's not imminent, but it's somewhere on the horizon.
George, next question is for you. Gustav on Facebook asks, to make it more equal with the part-time drivers who'll be in the WRC next year, he suggests the starting order should go by average points per rally started. What do you think about that?
I think that's an absolutely brilliant idea. I've already been speculating along those lines. That my solution was to allow the stewards to decide the start order, as long as we've got a stipendary steward in there that, that understands what he's doing. Yeah, so I mean, I would suggest that that would be a brilliant idea. Average points, average on the points scored. I think that's a pretty good start. I'm not sure it would be enough. I would say that system plus the option for stewards to reassign seeding as the sporting sporting equity would allow it to do. It's a tricky one because people are going to say it's a fix, but actually it's not. I think it's absolutely valid. So great shout, and I love your idea. There we go.
There we go, Gustav.
You are now part of the Dirtfish World Council.
It's a dangerous
place to be. I've just invented right now. It's great. There isn't a Dirtfish World Council, I hasten to add, before I get anyone in Dirtfish into trouble. But there we go. Thank you.
Brilliant. Okay, so
good stuff. Amazing.
Yeah, great question. Majej, sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong, from Facebook asks us, and I think this is a great question, if you could ride in the co-driver seat of any driver, what would it be and on what stage and in what car? So I'm going to, before David asks me, I'm going to say this is at any point in WRC history. Co-driver's seat, who would you want to sit next to? David Evans?
Fairly predictable for anybody who knows me. It would be, I can even tell you the time and the place, it would be stage 21 of the 1995 RAC Rally, Sweet Lamb Hafren with Colin McRae, when he retook the lead from Carlos. And took something like 20 seconds or something out of everybody in Sweet Lamb, just in the dusk on probably what would it have been, Tuesday night or something. Fantastic. One of the finest moments in the history of our sport. So, yeah, and that would obviously have been in a Group A Subaru Impreza 555.
Yeah, okay. So mine is Stig Blomqvist. The stage is Bjälverud in the 1980s Swedish rally, and it's an Audi Quattro. When he just blitzed everybody down there, he basically didn't need pace notes for that stage, so I could legitimately jump in a car with him right now and repeat that in a nice snowy condition because he'll remember the stage. Stig Blomqvist, I never ever got a ride with Stig. I was lucky enough to get to sit in beside a number of other drivers. But never with Stig. I even got to ride with Hannah Mikkola in a Celica on the shakedown at Thousand Lakes. Was it 93, was it? I think it was 93 that Hannah did that with us. Anyhow, Stig Blomqvist, Audi Quattro, Bjälverud, it's about 20 odd kilometres, and it is a roller coaster of a stage. And David, you're wrong about. Sorry, Colin, you're wrong about it feeling safe. It will not feel safe. But it would be absolutely amazing, and the speed and explosive power, the limited amount of traction that the cars had, which is a key to making the cars spectacular. Not necessarily power, it's limiting the traction. There is so much we could do with this championship to make it spectacular. Another question. I'm stopping. I'm shutting up. Anyway, there you go. There's my shout. The wonderful Stig Blomqvist.
Brilliant. Thank you for that, George. That's a great answer. Next one, David, I'm going to send to you. When do you think M Sport will finally announce their lineup for 2024?
Well, they kind of have to give us some insight this week, obviously, with entries going in for Monte Carlo. So it doesn't necessarily mean that whoever drives for them in Monte is going to drive for them all season. We saw that a couple of years ago, didn't we, when Sebastian Loeb drove Monte and then a restricted program. So, yeah, we will definitely get an insight this week. But the team can evolve. What's the regulations now? They have to have a permanent P1 driver, George. They have to nominate.
That's it. Yes,
yeah, one driver. So, it's coming this week. I would expect.
Okay, stay tuned for that then. Everyone who asked that question. Colin, I'm going to give you this next one. Now, this was asked by Nigel and Bradley on Facebook and WRC Freak on X. How would you improve the WRC TV package?
I think it's easy to get confused. You know, unless you have an absolute objective about what you're trying to do with a TV package. It's easy to get confused. You know, if you're trying to cover a lot of bases with one type of product, with in any form, in any walk of life, you know, if you've got to be very specific about your audience, about your target market, about where you're going with your products. And my feeling is we're just a little bit too broad with what we're producing. We're not actually making something that is aimed at a specific audience. And, you know, everyone keeps giving us an example, Drive to Survive. They are very, very focused about what they do with that program. They know exactly what they've got to do. It's about characters. It's about controversy. It's not really about the sport. You know, okay, we're not producing anything like a Drive to Survive, but if we use that principle about where we should be in terms of who we're focusing on, who we're trying to attract to the sport, then we can learn a lot and we can do a lot with it. My issue or my concern is that we're a little bit too fixated on one element, and that could be the all-live element, and that maybe affects the sport's ability then to appeal with other products, other TV products, if you want to call it TV. I don't know, broadcast we'll call it these days because TV's kind of dead, isn't it? You know, maybe we're a little bit too fixated on one product, and that then means that we miss out on other opportunities because we're not really being maybe creative enough in other areas. So there is, in my view, quite a bit of work to do in terms of how we sell the sport. And at the top of that is, yeah, okay, a lot of us will talk about social media in terms of the way forward, but you're right, at the very top is the product that goes around the world, which is the TV product. Are we doing the best we can to maximise what our sport's all about? I'd argue we're probably not.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else want to chime in on that one? Sorry if that was a bit unfair, Colin. But the people have asked the questions.
It's got me into trouble before, James.
I'm just the messenger.
But we have to be open about these things. We have to be allowed to debate them. You know, it's what it's about. You know, we need to be in a position where people can voice their opinions. Because if you don't voice your opinion, you know, then you're doing yourself a disservice.
And it's a hot topic with fans, the TV package. You know, there's a lot of commentary about it, so it's definitely something that needs to be spoken about.
I'm probably the one of the three of us that watches most of it, because I tend to follow it through stage by stage, most events, and then get into deep analysis. So I really love it. I love the technical content that we get. But I miss a lot of the stage side footage, and like Colin, I think it could. For me, you need to get a Hollywood director in, to get somebody creative in to just really shake the whole thing up, because I think it would benefit from it massively. And I know there's commercial aspects, et cetera, which cannot be ignored, but at the same time, I don't think anything's being leveraged as much as it can. There's a degree of comfort in what we're getting, and it's being pared down quite clearly in accountants in the driving seat, because we're getting less strong technical coverage, if you like. We're getting blips and gripes in the system where it's not working correctly. You know, we know if it's going to rain, the footage is basically, you know, don't bother watching this morning, just check the times, you know, and I can check the stages later by watching the recordings when they put them up from the car, if I'm doing any technical analysis or I want to do any technical analysis. So there's my tuppence worth.
I think one thing we have to say is, you know, you still have to take your hats off to WRC Promoter for the job they actually do in producing from some incredibly difficult parts of the world. You know, it is arguably the most extreme broadcasting project. Yes, we've got Dakar and all of those, but still, to go from minus 30 in Sweden to plus whatever, and I know that's a marketing line that we trot out every year, it's a good achievement. It's a great achievement. But I think, you know, it's perhaps unfair just to look solely at rallying, because the question of what is broadcasting, what is TV, is a question that everybody faces. You know, Absolutely. You look at the likes of even, you know, NFL. They struggle to understand how to cover it now. You know, all of our children, Cole, you know, that nobody watches TV anymore. It's all on the phone.
David, this is exactly my point. But my point is, I don't think that's being looked into enough.
No, I think I think they are, you know, and I think it would be naive to think that the promoter is sitting on its hands there. The promoter understands it, and they are, I would say they are addressing it, but there's not a quick fix for a sport like ours, which is very difficult. And that then brings you to the next question of format. And for me, this is the bigger question, is we need to change the format. This continual 4 days being absolutely beholden to a power stage on a Sunday, it's a nonsense for me now. You know, we need a one-day event. We need a 36-hour event. We need a six-day event. We need variety. You know, appointment viewing is an anachronism now. It's rooted in TV. And people keep going back to Formula One. The race always starts at whatever it is, 1 or 2 o'clock, I can't remember. I don't care about that anymore. You know, that's an exception. You know, football, it used to start, rugby used to start at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. Yeah. Now, it does. You know, you've got Thursday night, Friday night, Monday night, Sunday night. Let's move with the times. Sorry, gone on.
Yeah, look, David, you're right. You're right. And it's you know, you've identified that, but... it is difficult. It is difficult to change. And as you say, it would be naive to think that they're not looking into this at the very top level in rallying. But my opinion or my worry is that, you know, we've had all live. They have done this incredible technological advancement in terms of the coverage. But that was 5 or 6 years ago and nothing has changed. We've not moved on. They've shown us they can do it. Let's move on. Let's see what we can do with this. Let's see how we can utilise this incredible technological advancement that you've shown us that you can master, and let's see how we can use it. Let's see how we can use it more. Let's see how we can use it better. Let's see how we can use it smarter. Nothing's changed, and that for me is the biggest worry.
Yeah, I think the job's evolving, and I'm sure that we will see changes coming.
I'm Kellen Koshel, and I just did my first Dirtfish course, which was the one-day women's course. My biggest surprise was how calm it could be in the car, and the calmer I was, the faster I could make the car go. The surprising thing about driving was that it wasn't necessarily a mental thing. I had to really get out of my head and into my body more, and I just felt a little more comfortable doing that for the first time around a group of women. But I will say, I do feel like I could do any of the Dirtfish courses now. I kind of know what to expect, and you know, hopefully more women get into motorsports, and then any day could be an all-women's day if just enough of us are in the sport. If I were talking to someone who was thinking about taking a class but was kind of on the fence, it would be, you know, what are you waiting for? It's such a fun experience. You're going to really learn something, and you're going to push your limits, and maybe you'll even have some more confidence.
Thank you to all of our US-based fans who asked this one. And the question is, where do things stand with the WRC returning to the US, and where should that rally be? David Evans, what are your thoughts on that?
It is coming, I think. There are some issues in America. I think it's fair to say that the insurance aspect of the event remains a challenge. And from what I can see, we longer term, it's fair to say that the Seattle and Pacific Northwest, Washington, we would always be very, very interested in looking at a WRC round. But probably in the short to medium term, it is, from what I can understand, there's Tennessee, Chattanooga, and there's also Kentucky. Kentucky is looking really strong as well. There's lots of options in Kentucky. So, yeah, one of the two. And I would say... next year I would imagine be a challenge, but not impossible. It's okay. Still there's potential there. So yeah, that's that.
Brilliant. That sounds exciting. George, where would you put a rally in the US if you could pick an area?
Craig, yeah, I don't know enough about it. I was, as David suggests, I was up in the Pacific Northwest. I was in Oregon Trail Rally this year, and that was amazing. I mean, that event had everything you needed to make a WRC event, including remote services in towns, a little bit like Australia Rally used to be when we went down to Collie and all the different places down in Western Australia. So it was a great concept, movable service areas each day, a different service point each day, basically. And of course, I would open up rallying to even more flexibility than that, to allow it to work and breathe. But I really quite fancy the area up there. Is it in Minnesota or in the north of Ohio, is it? And around the Great Lakes, where you were with Brenton Kelly, Colin.
Yeah.
That was on the east coast, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The east coast of Superior. So, I mean, these areas and these stages seem to be just absolutely fantastic. I mean, rallying is a sport that basically, I mean, it's called a European sport because all sort of racing started off on the gravel and they were basically rallies. But in US, the sport of rally is it should be a US sport. It shouldn't be a European sport because there's so much of the country and so many people enjoy driving rurally and they've had these great big powerful cars. Their entire heritage is automotive. So I would love to see the WRC going to the US, wherever it can be managed safely, manageably and sustainably. And I would like to think that they would do it their own way, which I think would be brilliant, and they should be allowed to, and give us a great new event, please. Wherever, just do it. Let's get out there.
Yeah, that would be fantastic, certainly. Colin, I'm going to throw another one your way. This comes from Peter on Facebook, and he asks, how did Dirtfish turn around our stage morning interviews videos so fast? Is there a large team behind the scenes? He says it's impressive. Keep it up. Colin, we've not got our wonderful videographer, Elliot Barnard, with us. So can you answer this one for us?
Well, you've answered it. It is Elliot.
Pretty simple.
It is Elliot Barnard. We are very, very fortunate at Dirtfish to have one of the most talented young videographers I've ever worked with. And I've worked with a lot of videographers, young and old, in my time. And Elliot is absolutely, he's outstanding. He really is. His work ethic is just unbelievable. It's hard work, and he just works hard. He really does.
And he literally works everywhere as well, doesn't he, Cole?
You know,
if he's hanging upside down, he's still got his laptop open, and he's, you know, everywhere. He's in the back of the car working. It's remarkable.
And that,
do you hang him upside down if he does something wrong to punish him and then he still has to work, David? I know you're a hard taskmaster, but this is beyond even my expectation.
Shout out to Elliot because he really does do a great job. And he turns them around. You know, we do the interviews as quickly as we can before the first stage. You know, the drivers stop generally for a few minutes, maybe 10 or 15 minutes before the start of the opening stage. We'll do our interviews, jump into the car. We're generally heading towards maybe the end of that first stage, just to pick anything up that might happen. And all that time, Elliot's in the back of the car, head down, laptop open, editing. And he edits, he uploads.
He'd be a great co-driver, Colin, because he obviously doesn't get car sick.
He doesn't get car sick. And if you've been with David and some of David's driving, you would be astonished.
Steady.
He manages to work.
Car sickness isn't allowed. That's a sackable offence.
Clearly. Yeah.
But we have talked, Cole, haven't we, about even trying to improve that service further by taking the pre-stage interviews live, and if we could find a solution, we would possibly do that.
Yeah, but again, David, we need to, you know, this is for obviously a team meeting at some point, but it kind of goes back to something I talked about earlier on with the TV coverage. You know, the benefit of live. You know, is there a benefit of doing them live? Is there a tangible benefit of doing them live, or is it best just to allow Elliot to work a little bit of magic, have an extra 20 minutes and put them up 20 minutes later? I suppose it depends on the type of package you're doing, but we have this headlong rush in rallying for live coverage. And it's like, well, actually, not everything does need to be live. Not everything needs to be live. Are we missing out on other opportunities because we're absolutely fixated with live? And I'm not just talking about the WRC here. I look through all levels of rallying, your national championships, from the British Championships to, you know, the Roger Albert Clark that ran, to rounds of the Australian Championship, the Middle East Championship. You know, there's this headlong dash to doing live stuff. And it's like, well, you know, it costs you a lot of money. You know, could you be maybe using your resources in a better way to produce more targeted packages? I don't know.
It's a very good point. And we'll have that team meeting, so stay tuned.
Sorry, mate.
Anyway, Elliot getting a well-deserved shout out there. So there you go, Peter. There's no big team. There's an Elliot Barnard who does all of that. George, next question is coming your way, and This is a slightly interesting one from Alex on X. Could gravel crews be replaced by helicopters?
In a short answer, no, it couldn't be. I've got a great idea for altering pace notes though, and then it would lend itself to a system to allow a single crew to go through pre rally car pass on the day, which would then feed into the system that they have, a heads up display.
Mm.
Would be amazing. Would be absolutely amazing. So 3D image overlaid on a smart little heads up display like a fighter pilot. Great bit of technology to add to cars. And you wouldn't do away with pace notes because you need the ins and the outs and the little insights and the prods and the reminders. It would just change the role slightly, but the driver would have an extra visual overlay showing the road. And then the safety could be laid in on that. So no, helicopters wouldn't do the job at all. I'd be far from it, sadly. Maybe in the likes of Safari, they could, but that's been tried once. Colin McRae. It was Marco Martin had to drive a whole stage with no pace notes. Yeah, so it simply wouldn't work as a concept because you need the detailed overlay for each corner. The gravel notes, ice notes in Monte, they're very specific, you know, and even telling you which part of the road is likely to ice, and you know, it's down to when it might freeze. So there's a lot of live feedback that could come back to the drivers with a very simple bit of technology being applied that exists already, I feel, just to be adapted to a rally car. Might be quite expensive to do, but it'd be great fun. God, I'd love to do that. Amazing. There we go.
Pick one rally you could add to make your ultimate WRC calendar. George Donaldson, which one are you adding?
Wow. That really has been sprung on us, hasn't it? I genuinely would always want to see New Zealand rally in the championship.
Yeah.
But having said that, getting very parochial here, very Scottish, we have some incredible forest stages in Scotland. Personally, I have, just for fun, I still have hankerings to become a clerk of the course again. I was a clerk of the course of about five rallies back in the early 80s. I've done everything in this sport. I really genuinely have. But in the northeast of Scotland, up around Aberdeen and to the west, obviously, of Aberdeen, if you go east, you get into the water. South, north, and east, and west, obviously. The 35-mile stages in the forest with dozens and dozens of access points for spectators to get in and see, and very challenging stages. And then, you know, you can go slightly further north. Beautiful scenery, amazing stages. They'll stand one pass only, and I would make that a 300-mile, 500-kilometre WRC event, and it would be based out of probably Aviemore, but remote services every day, so no central servicing. It would be an incredible event, but the classics are I'd just like to see all them back in, many of the classics, run properly.
Yeah. David, you've had some time to think.
What do you think you're adding? For me, it would have to be America. And I know America is on its way, but the sooner the better. You know, I've been, like George, fortunate enough to be out and cover some ARA rounds this year, and just the enthusiasm, the community, and just the sheer love of the sport is absolutely huge in America, and America deserves a WRC round. And for me, Seattle is the perfect place. You know, the history with the Olympus Rally, of course, the press on regardless was out of Detroit and Michigan to start with, but the last time WRC was there was in Pacific Northwest, and Seattle is a fantastic city. It's got everything that you need. Certainly Dirtfish is there to host the service park or super specials or whatever, and some of the roads, you know, they are just fantastic. Yeah.
They're amazing. Absolutely amazing. Like Monte Carlo, some of them.
Yeah. And all there, you know, gravel roads, logging roads. It would just be fabulous to see America. Presumably Colly, you would be pushing for Australia?
Yeah, maybe Australia. Australia or New Zealand, maybe. But Argentina, goodness me, you know. You know, much as I love Australia and New Zealand, Argentina just gives so much colour. Okay, we're in Chile, but it's nothing like the same. It really isn't. Argentina would be great. I did notice this week there was a WRC delegation, I think in Ecuador, talking to the Ecuadorian government about a potential round of the WRC. But we need to sort out Argentina. It just gives the championship just something very, very special. And that's what it needs. You know, you talk about crowds and you talk about atmosphere and you talk about, you know, just incredible scenery, incredible footage. And Argentina delivers all of that. And it needs to, the championship needs to find a way to get it back.
Yeah.
And why are we not there, Colin?
Finance.
They couldn't pay the WRC promoter the fee.
It's true that, Colin. Shocking. I remember the time when we drove El Condor, probably to a... Now, I think actually it was probably the night before. We were coming back up from Santa Rosa and we ducked off and drove through El Condor stage. And we were still at least 18 hours before the first car was coming through. And the place was just banging, wasn't it? It was just
it was incredible.
Full. Yeah, and literally every other corner, we were being stopped and offered steak and all sorts of weird beers and stuff. And it was just, it was actually really emotional.
Tremendous.
It is a great place. Are we pretty much halfway through now? Should we now call this and make this part one of a two-parter?
I think that makes sense.
Yes.
I think that's a good call. So... yeah, let's wrap it up there then, guys. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. We'll see you very soon for part two. It's probably just up there in your list of podcasts. Thanks very much for listening, everyone, and we'll see you for part two.